Furlong Reel 1. Now then, what first raised your interest in flying?
Well, as a small boy, I suppose I was like most small boys interested in mechanical things, and flying was something new, and it caught my imagination.
I suppose the fact that you were living near Hendon was a major source of stimulus to you.
Well, it certainly helped. When you see an aeroplane, it increases the interest naturally, and I took the opportunity of going as near as I could whenever I could.
Now, about this time we're discussing now, which would be summer of 1914 or so, how much activity was there going on at Hendon? How frequently did you see aircraft?
Well, they were flying every day, and at weekends, of course, they had shows in the summer, in the good weather, and people, which was an attraction to the general public, went and paid for admission. Oh, there was quite a lot of activity.
And would the aircraft be very much in evidence to people who lived around Hendon?
I mean, yes.
They wouldn't be just confined to the aerodrome.
No, because an aeroplane is visible from quite a distance, even if it's only a few hundred feet up. Oh, yes, you were very obvious to everybody within the vicinity. Mm. And the noise, of course, attracted your attention.
Do you have any outstanding memories of this period when your interest in flying was first raised?
Well, from school, we used to go down towards the airfield, especially on days when there looked like some activity, and word got around that a parachute jump was going to be made, one of the first, if not the first, in the country, and we were there. I was there with one or two of my friends, and finally we saw an aeroplane go up with what appeared to be a man sitting on the strut, on the undercarriage strut, with a great bundle in his arm. So this is, of course, what it was. And they climbed up to, I wouldn't know what height, probably a couple of thousand feet. And then the bundle detached itself and out streamed the parachute and opened out. And the man landed. And to our great joy, he missed the airfield and landed 3 or 4 fields from us. And we rushed across, as schoolboys would, with the object of getting nearer, and he asked us to help him pull out the parachute and fold it up, by which time, halfway through that job, the people arrived from the airfield to see whether he'd broken his neck or not.
Mm. The parachute was fairly similar to modern parachutes, was it?
Yes, as far as I can recollect, it was silk and umbrella-shaped in the normal way. I don't think there was anything peculiar about it.
Now, at this time you were still at school. You'd be about 16 or 17 when you first decided that you were going to take some steps to learn to fly yourself. Well, what, in fact, were the first steps you took?
Well, I tentatively put the suggestion to my father, who was a quiet sort of man and didn't say very much, but he was interested in all these sort of things. He was one of the very early motorists and all that sort of thing. And I thought this was a bit much, but I'd try it. He didn't turn it down, but he didn't show any great enthusiasm. And finally, one day, after 2 or 3 attempts, he said, well, go and find something about it. Find out something about it, let me know. So I did.
Well, what did you do exactly?
Well, I went along to Hendon and I said, I would like to learn to fly. What's the drill? And somehow or other, I found myself at the Hall School of Fly. I don't think I asked for that particular school, but anyway, I went along. And there was a man who turned out to be Mr. Hall, who asked me what I wanted to do. And I said, well, I'd like to learn to fly. So he said, all right, well, it'll cost you £75, and would you like to look round and see the aeroplanes? Not that I knew much about what they were, but I looked round and I went back.
What did you see when you looked around? Can you describe it?
Well, there were two hangars, wooden hangars, with a sort of open workshop at the back, benches and bits and pieces lying around. Wheels and struts and all that sort of thing, and in the corner a little tin pot office, and aeroplanes, perhaps one in the hangar and one or two outside.
What kind?
Codrons. They were all Codrons. 35 horse and 45 horse.
So he might, have had two or three of those.
Yeah. I think he had three 35 horse, that was the three-cylinder, and one 45 horse, which was the sort of elite. I don't remember any of the others.
Did he give you a flight?
Yes.
What do you remember of that?
Whether it was the first time I saw him or not, I don't know. But, oh, I was very thrilled, and I thought, this is the job for me. He just took me round a fairly wide circuit and landed, and that was that. And whatever I did at the time, I wasn't competent to sign. My father had to sign. But I took the papers away with joy, and I signed that I would, or my father signed that he would pay the necessary money.
Now, when you've got as far as this and decided, with your father's approval, to have flying lessons at the Hall School, you started off on these lessons while you were still a schoolboy. What do you remember of those first few lessons? What they involved?
Well, the chief thing is they involved an awful lot of waiting about, because we were only allowed to fly when it was dead still. In other words, when the smoke went more or less straight up, which only occurred normally at the crack of dawn or dusk. So we hung about, and then probably the wind would get up and we wouldn't fly. And this happened repeatedly. And finally, you'd be put in an aeroplane and given your first instruction. But it was a long, great deal of hanging about. That was my early recollection.
What was the drill in these first few lessons that you did?
Well, you were sat in the aeroplane, strapped in, and you were told about the engine. In fact, the engine, the throttle was wide open all the time, and there was a switch on the outside. You controlled the engine by the switch and nothing else. You gave it bursts of engine, and to start with, of course, you gave very short bursts with long intervals of it running free. And that was how you started.
What about, did you actually move the aircraft?
Oh, yes. At Hendon, on the far side, there was a great white patch on the fence. The aeroplane was already facing it. And you were told, of course, how the rudder worked. Keep the control stick in the centre. And you were to try and get over near to that white fence, but not to it. Because if you got to it, you couldn't turn around. And then, of course, the fun started, because an aeroplane, that sort of aeroplane, was extremely difficult to steer, because it had two booms, and not a fuselage or a tail wheel, just two booms, which tried to make it run in one direction only. And the only way to turn it was to give it a burst, which lifted the tail up, and then you could swing it a little bit. Invariably, you swung it too far. So what happened was, you went across the airfield in a shocking series of S-turns, and the first time, they didn't expect to see you back for half an hour. In fact, they often used to have to come over the other side and rescue you, because you got too near to the fence. They hadn't allowed enough room to turn round. When you got within, say, 100 yards of the fence, then you put on full rudder and open the engine. The tail would lift and you'd start to turn, and by the time you'd decided you'd gone round, it was too late, and you'd gone round 1.5 times. But after many, many attempts at this, you gradually got the hang of it. Of course, at this stage, you might easily find another learner doing the same trick, and your object was to keep away from him. Well, having turned round, you'd start to struggle back to your starting point. And when you got back, if you got back within a reasonable time, all right. But if you had to come and be rescued because you got too near the fence, you got some very rude words from the instructor, which I remember happened on one occasion. Anyway, after trying this quite a few times, you gradually got the hang of it, and you could go fairly straight, turn round, and come fairly straight back. And you keep doing this. And, of course, you learnt after a while that the more you were on the wheels, in other words, the more you lifted the tail, the more easily it was to control. But, of course, the risk then was you might come off the ground, which they kept warning you about. Well, after a while, you got so that you could go straight to the fence, stop, turn around and come straight back. And as in most cases, one day you suddenly found yourself off the ground, to your great surprise and consternation, because you were keeping the engine on longer than you were expected to, and all of a sudden the ground went. You got the impression that you were 50 feet up. You were probably 3 feet, as a matter of fact. And then you had been told what to do. You blipped the engine, and that let you down. And if you were in the same position, you just drop until you were on the ground again. Well, the normal procedure was, when you got back, having done that, the instructor would tear you into ribbons, but he didn't mean it, because you had done a fairly straight flight and you'd landed all right. So then you'd be told to go and do that same thing again. You'd do that.
Now, during these first few days of experience with the aircraft, when you were concentrating on these runs up and down the airfield, how much work with the airplane would you be able to get in, say on an average kind of day? Half an hour or?
Yes, you'd do half an hour, I should think, would be about the time. As you got, yes, I suppose half an hour would be expected. There were perhaps half a dozen pupils. As you got better, of course, half an hour was a longer time. And therefore, you didn't require so much time. You could do quite a bit of flying in quarter of an hour.
So even so, you had to spend a lot of time at Hendon in relation to the actual time you spent with the aircraft.
Tremendous time, yes.
What kind of things would you do when you weren't actually working with the airplane?
Oh, I suppose we got into mischief. I don't know what we did.
These first few days when you, well, these first few months, I expect, when you were at the Hall School, while you were still a schoolboy yourself, did this work out satisfactorily from your training point of view?
No. I realised that it didn't fit in with school curriculum, because obviously you can't leave school before dawn and they don't like you out after dark. So having struggled along for a month or two like that, I went to my father and said, no, this won't do. If I'm going on with this, I just have to leave school and do it seriously, you see.
Had the school learned about your flying training?
Yes, the school learnt by being the our captain in charge of the OTC, of which I belonged. We were being inspected by some big pot, I don't know who he was, and he was boasting and said, and this boy is learning to fly at Hendon. Of course, all the school's ears opened wide and their eyes popped out, and it was round the school like a flash. Up till then it had been a secret.
Now, so you took this decision to leave school so that you could concentrate on learning to fly on a full-time basis. How did you set yourself up at Hendon so you could do this?
Well, I went to Hendon and I made inquiries about digs, and I found some digs with a rotund lady by the name of Mrs. Curtis, who turned out to be a very nice person, and she had one or two apprentices from a local factory. I think there were four of us living in the house, and I was the only one learning to fly, and then I used to get up at the crack of dawn and go off by myself to the airfield, which was 3/4 mile up the road.
Could you give me your general impressions of what Hendon was like at this time? You were talking about the beginning of 1915 now. What was the setup there? How big was it? What was the sort of scale of operations?
Well, I don't think it was as big as it was latterly, but it was a big field surrounded by a fence, and on the south side were the hangars. I don't think there was any. The north side was completely a railway embankment. And along the south side there was a sort of track, and off the track were these various hangars of two or three schools. There was the Hall School, the Ruffy Bowman School, the Beatty Wright School, and then a bit further still was the Graham White School. There may have been another school or two, I don't remember. That's how the field was set out. It was all grass, of course, and then set round some way in from the fence, quite a way in from the fence, were a number of pylons. I think there were six of them. Open structures, gaily painted so they could easily be seen. I don't remember the colours, but red and white or something of that sort. With numbers on. And these were the circuit for racing. And on a show day, the aeroplanes used to fly around these pylons, getting as close to them and to the ground as they could, which all thrilled the people, and it was a very spectacular show.
You mentioned these various flying schools that existed at Hendon at the time. What were relations like between them? Any sense of competition or anything?
Yes, there was a general sort of rivalry. We, like there would be anywhere, we tore the other chap to bits and he tore us to bits. But we were genuinely interested. We used to go and watch each other's operations if we weren't engaged on our own. Of course, another thing I didn't mention was that quite often in the many hours of spare time, we used to go and help them repair or do jobs to the aircraft or to the hangar, or perhaps help the chap overhaul the engine, that sort of thing. Anything to keep us interested, and I think most of us had motorcycles which we looked after in the spare time.
So relations were cooperative rather than competitive.